I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. 40 years ago this month, Marc Garneau became the first Canadian to fly to outer space. It was one of the country's proudest moments and inspired a nation into a new era of space exploration. Garneau would return to space 2 more times, and after a career as a naval officer in the Canadian Armed Forces, as well as leading the Canadian Space Agency, he entered the world of politics, winning election to the House of Commons in 2008. When the Liberal Party was elected the government in 2015, he was appointed Minister of Transport, and later on in 2021 served as Minister of Foreign Affairs. He recounts all that and more in a new memoir, A Most Extraordinary Ride, Space, Politics, and the Pursuit of a Canadian Dream. I'll ask him about space, what it's like to experience space physically, intellectually, emotionally, and spiritually. As well, I'll ask him about the future of space travel and exploration. We'll talk about his time in politics. He was a transport minister as well as foreign minister through a tumultuous time in Canadian politics. The pandemic, the arbitrary detention of Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, among many other notable events over the last decade. And I'll get him to reflect on whatever his relationship was with Justin Trudeau. This new book is published by Signal. We spoke last Wednesday. Please welcome to the Plant Online program the Honorable Marc Garneau. Mr. Garneau, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. What's fascinating when I read your book, A Most Extraordinary Ride, it is a most extraordinary life that you've led, because it opens in 1969. You're watching the moon landing. And, you know, somebody who was born in the 1940s, as you were, and then see that in 1969, it just must have been fun to see the possibility of space in that span of time of your lifetime, up to that point, say.
Absolutely. The dawning of a new era began in 1957 when Sputnik was launched by the Soviet Union, and that meant that rockets could go into space and either place satellites there or even take people. And to be living in that era, I consider myself very fortunate, and to have been young enough to watch it all and to be a potential candidate to maybe do it myself one day, it was a very exciting possibility.
And I guess even in 1969, did you think that you'd go to space one day?
No, I didn't. I was just fascinated by it. It may have planted a seed, though, because I thought, wow, what an exciting thing that would be. In this particular case, they had gone all the way to the moon and landed on the moon, which is something that, you know, we haven't done now for 50 years, more than 50 years.
Yeah.
So it was really, truly a breathtaking accomplishment. And I was just as marveling just as much at human ingenuity to build the necessary hardware to take people safely to the moon and to bring them back safely.
Yeah.
You know, rising to the challenge that John F. Kennedy had thrown at the United States back in 1963, and I remember that speech. And so, you know, it was inspiring, but it didn't make me say, I want to be an astronaut, not at that point.
You do a marvelous job in the book about talking about that process, seeing a newspaper ad, if I recall, and applying for that, and then that was your entry into the space program through to the flights, and, you know, even just what it's like in flight. The thing that I was wondering about was motion sickness in space and at all comparable to, say, car sickness or seasickness that we might experience, eh?
I think the symptoms are pretty similar, and they go all the way from, you know, a mild headache to a vertigo to nausea to cold sweats, and including all the way to vomiting. I've seen it, and no names,
yeah.
But I've seen it, and it is, I think, it's very similar to either seasickness or air sickness or car sickness.
You write in the book that space is experienced on 4 levels, the physical, the intellectual, the emotional. I am curious about the spiritual, because you do talk in the book about your relationship to religion, say, and how that's evolved, say, into your adulthood. I can't help but think, you know, reading about your experience in space and just looking at the universe as it is, that there can't be something divine involved in all of this. I mean, as someone who's been to space, who's seen the Earth from that angle that we've only seen, say, through pictures, how do you think it all happened?
Well, that's, you're asking the most important question of all time. And yes, you think about that more. I was an engineer, so I've always had an inquisitive mind. And as you point out, I've struggled with my faith at times in my life. And it centers around the fact that we have no proof. And yet, here we are, living in a universe that was created, roughly 15 billion years ago, that is so vast, it's mind-boggling. And how does that just happen by itself? You know, that initial release of energy in the Big Bang and the creation of millions of constellations and millions of star systems. You got to sort of say to yourself, well, you know, if you're an engineer, something had to be at the origin of that. And that is the question that I think any thinking person has been asking themselves since the beginning of time.
Yeah, I guess after all these years, you're not yourself closer to any answer, say?
No, I'm not. The mystery is still as deep as it has always been. I want to believe that there is a divine presence, but as an engineer, I have, as a person who relies on scientific evidence, I'm still waiting to see if something will tip me more into being certain.
The other thing that I found fascinating as I was reading your book was in preparing for space. You have to contend for all sorts of possibilities, including death. Having gone through that and preparing for it as you have, does that help at all when you're back on Earth and dealing with, say, problems day to day, or even, you know, important to people around you, life itself, say?
I make the comment after my space flight that one of the things that changed with me was that because I had, if you like, risen to the occasion and undertaken this space flight and the first Canadian and representing my country, and it had gone successfully, and I had had to, you know, do something that carried risk, it gave me confidence that I could deal with pretty much any other problem that would come my way. It was a tremendous confidence builder because I said to myself, I didn't know whether I was going to be able to, you know, carry this all out successfully, and I did. And I confronted the fear that one has of getting in a rocket and going into space, and it gave me a lot of confidence, and I'm not saying that I don't worry anymore. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm more calm in the face of the kinds of human dramas and scary things that can happen in one's life since I had that flight.
Yeah, you talk about the I guess it's what, 2.5-3 hours when you're strapped in and just about to be launched into space. A time like that teaches you patience, at least I would think.
It does, and it's very, very long. And, you know, human beings are not very good at just being by themselves being alone with their thoughts. They tend to look for distractions so that, especially when they're contemplating something as heavy duty as the fact that, you know, when this countdown is over, this space shuttle is going to release 7 million pounds of thrust and take me to space in 8.5 minutes. It's an uncomfortable sort of period, and it's not like simply going into the woods and sitting down and meditating for 2.5 hours, because you know that after that 2.5 hours, you'll get up and go back home. Yeah. But in this particular case, not only are you, especially on your first flight, going into the unknown, but you're taking some risk. And so you think about some very fundamental things. You want to have peace of mind. You want to know that you left your family in a state of harmony, that you told them how much you loved them, that you want to convince yourself that you are ready for this mission, and because you know that in this particular case, all of Canada was watching, or pretty much, mm-hmm. and you don't want to disappoint them. Those kinds of thoughts go through your mind during that interminable 2.5 hours before liftoff. And fortunately, the countdown, if it goes well, ends up with you actually then living the experience, and then you're totally focused on that.
How many hours of sleep would you get, say, a day?
They reserved 8 hours for us yeah. every night. And so, and you know, we had meals, a break for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so it was pretty much like an Earth routine, except that in the space of a 24-hour period, we would actually see 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets because we went around the Earth 16 times. So that's kind of interesting. But, yeah. but they try to keep a kind of an Earth routine as much as possible because humans perform better if their routine is remains regular.
When asleep, were you able to dream, say?
I don't remember whether I dreamed while I was in space. I've certainly dreamed about being in space since I've been back on Earth,
yeah.
but I don't honestly remember whether I dreamt during the time that I was in space. Possibly I did.
Yeah. There is an incident in the book from your childhood that you write about. This incident at Camp Kinkora, did I pronounce that
yeah.
right? This involved a camp director who,
yeah.
I don't know, how would you describe it? I mean, it is a troubling moment in your life, and I guess something that you never talked about and something that you never really thought about, I guess until after you found out that this camp director had been charged with various offenses. In terms of contending with that and thinking about that as you were growing up, I guess we all handle these things in different ways. In your experience, how were you able to, say, move on from that?
I didn't fully understand it. I was very confused by it. And in my particular case, I wasn't physically abused,
mm-hmm.
but I was, you know, told to take off my clothes, and I was stared at. That's what I recall. And I can understand why young people are totally confused by this and tend to stay quiet about it. It's as though this is something I mustn't talk about. And so I kind of buried it, which I think is not at all unusual. And then it can resurface at a later time, as it did when this particular camp director was accused of being being a pedophile,
mm-hmm.
which he was. So it was something that I literally buried, and I think that the human mind is capable, in certain situations that are very, very unpleasant, is able to do that, or at least that seemed to be what happened with me. I didn't sort of suddenly fall apart after that. I just sort of buried it, and but it resurfaced when the name became public later.
Yeah, and I guess we can understand why people don't say anything at one point and then may say something later.
Children are you know, brought up to respect authority,
mm.
adult authority, and of course pedophiles take advantage of that, and children are totally defenseless.
We're skipping about here because there's just so much in this book that I'd like to ask you about. But to get to politics, you write in the book about the poor chemistry between you and Prime Minister Trudeau. Do you think this goes back to that 2013 leadership race when you asked him in a debate whether he thought he was qualified? Do you think he resented you from then on?
You know, I asked myself that question, but the truth is that he appointed me when we became the government as transport minister. So I chose to think that he did not bear me a grudge, although, you know, I did ask him a very difficult question.
And as we read the book, we see that you guys really didn't talk very much from then on, even when you're transport minister or foreign affairs minister. There were very few conversations between the two of you.
Yeah, well, to a certain extent, ministers should be able to do their job without adult supervision. And I didn't feel the need to consult on every single matter. But, you know, and this is not the end of the world, but, you know, our personalities were different personalities. And, you know, I just didn't happen to be in, you know, his circle of best friends. But that doesn't mean we were not able to talk to each other. The important thing in the relationship between a prime minister and his ministers is trust. And I think I had his trust. I was always loyal to him. It's just that, you know, he did not feel any need to sort of ever ask me very much about anything. It was basically do your job and just get on with it. And I did my job and got on with it. And you don't need to have that close relationship to be able to do your job competently. But the thought of being able to, you know, maybe get a call once in a while from the prime minister who says to you, Mark, you know, why don't you come over for a few minutes? Let's just talk, see how things are going. And I'd like to ask your advice on a couple of things. You know, I think that that's something that as a leader in my own sphere during my life, I used to do because I thought it was important in terms of the personal relationship. It's not absolutely necessary, but it's not something that really happened. And that's just an observation. You know, it's not a condemnation. It's just an observation. And I know that there are ministers who he was much closer to, but my job was to do my job competently. It would have been nice if we had been closer, but that's the way it is.
You write about your time in the transport department or the transport ministry. I find it fascinating when news stories come up about, you know, ports going on strike or pilots going on strike or rail workers, say. As transport minister, you want to keep everything moving. Is a trigger reaction for you to legislate them back to work? And I mean, I know you want to avoid that as a minister, as a politician. But how often do you have to get talked down from, say, something like that?
So it's a delicate process when a strike occurs, because the two sides, you want to bring them together and find a solution. But you must allow them to try to figure out a way without sticking your nose into it or immediately resorting to back-to-work legislation. You have to respect the collective bargaining process. It's there for a purpose. And I had 5 strikes during the time I was there. I was Minister of Transport for over 5 years. And in all cases, it was resolved fairly quickly and without return to work legislation. So that's the ideal case. There's no question about it. When transport workers go on strike, they have an enormous impact on the economy of the country, because we're a trading nation and we move vast amounts of goods and commodities by train, by ship, to the rest of the world, across the border and across the country. So whenever they do go on strike, there's an immediate effect, and not to mention the fact that there are a lot of people who at the receiving end are waiting for their goods and are not going to get their goods. So you always try to push pretty hard. And in my particular case, when it was a transport-driven, when it was a transport workers' strike, I would work with the Minister of Labor, and the two of us would talk to both sides. And without telling them what to do, we would just encourage them very, very forcefully to try to find a solution. And they were aware of that as well, the impact it was having. And so I was fortunate that in the 5 cases that I had to deal with, the number of strike days was very short, and we didn't have to sort of legislate them back, because I think that sort of breaks a bond of trust between union workers and the government.
You were Minister of Foreign Affairs when the two Michaels were released. Looking back at it and the way it was all handled even before your time in that office, do you think that their release could have been hastened, say?
I think we did the best. I don't think that we should have, remember the timeline here. The United States asked Canada, and we have a treaty with them, to detain Meng Wanzhou at Vancouver Airport because they wanted to extradite her to the United States to face charges. And we have always respected that treaty, and we would expect the Americans to do the same if we made a similar request. It was only shortly after that that the two Michaels were detained. It didn't happen at the same time or before Meng Wanzhou was detained in Canada. So China was clearly retaliating. And once that happens, it's important for you to remain consistent. You don't suddenly abandon your principles. You don't suddenly decide that you're not going to respect the treaty anymore. What you have to turn your mind towards is trying to find a solution that will allow the matter to be resolved in such a way as you can bring the two Michaels back. Unfortunately, this took a very, very long time. It's 1,019 days in jail, and it was painful for the Michaels, most of all, of course, then their families, and I spoke to them on many occasions and the pain that they were feeling, and then collectively for Canada, because we felt that this was outrageous, that two of our citizens had been detained unfairly, arbitrarily, and put in jail by the Chinese government. But we worked at it, and even though sometimes it appeared as though we were not making any progress, we did eventually find a resolution to it, and that was working very closely with the United States.
Finally, I'd just like to go back to space for a moment. I'm sure you've been asked this for years about, you know, with all the problems we have on Earth, all the poverty and the sort, why we're spending billions of dollars to go to space. And then I think over the years you've also been asked whether we should just send robots instead of people to space. How do you respond to say, those concerns that are legitimate from a lot of people?
Sure. And I talk about that in the book. If you're talking about the non-human side of thing, it's easy to persuade people that it's money well spent, because communication satellites allow you with your cell phone to phone anybody anywhere on the planet. GPS satellites allow you to figure out exactly where you're standing on the surface of the planet. Weather satellites tell you about approaching hurricanes, and Earth observation satellites tell you about what's happening down on the surface of the planet. Those are all extremely important. And Canadians, when you tell them about that, say, yeah, okay, that's money well spent.
Right.
When you talk about the human side of things, it's a different matter, because some people feel, well, why don't we just send robots? And I think we should send robots, certainly to places where humans can't go, or on precursor missions before sending humans. But in the end, C-3PO and R2-D2 are cute machines, but they're machines. And, there's a thirst on the part and I've found this in my 40 years when people have asked me questions about what it's like to be in space, they want to hear from human beings. I think sending humans to space inspires a lot of people, certainly young people. And so I think it is money well spent.
Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it, Joseph.
The book is called A Most Extraordinary Ride, Space Politics and the Pursuit of a Canadian Dream. It's published by Signal. Its author, Mark Garneau, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plateau.